be worshipped. I want to be loved.
I've told you a million times not to talk to me when I'm doing my lashes.
Oh, it's you. I didn't know you with all your clothes on.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
What am I going to tell you? You look like a woman.
Well, girls, looks like it's back to the perfume counter for me. And by the way, there's a name for you ladies, but it isn't used in high society, outside of a kennel.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Goulburn Girls. I am your co-host, Meredith, and I am joined, as always, by my lovely co-host, Amelia. Right now, she's actually having trouble with a fire drill going off in her apartment. So normally she would say hi to you, but she's saying hi in her spirit right now. Anyway, so today we're going to talk about two Doris Day films that come later in her career. First, we're going to talk about Pillow Talk from 1959, and then we're also going to talk about Midnight Lace from 1960. Two completely different kinds of movies. Midnight Lace, especially, I think I'm really excited to talk about because it's a way different kind of tone for Doris Day. So we'll do that later. Amelia's going to take over that part, and I will be talking about Pillow Talk. But before we do the actual movie talk, we have something important to address to our audience, and Amelia actually is going to take over that part. Essentially, just to introduce kind of what she's going to say, this is something that was said on the last podcast episode in reference to Doris Day supposedly having kind of a diva complex at one point in her career, and basically somebody's reaction to that. So without further ado, don't let me introduce this more than it needs to be said, because Amelia is going to talk about it. Amelia, I'm going to go through it to you to address the audience about this pressing situation.
All right. So if you hear anything in the background that's saying, please do not use the elevators, just ignore it. Because I can't, you know, apparently today's a good day to test the fire alarms in my apartment complex. But anyway, so we got a message from a listener from our last Doris Day podcast that we did that was more towards the beginning of her career. And I noted that she had a diva complex at one point and that she had several affairs. You know, she was seeing people several times all at once. So, like, she was seeing Martin Melcher and she was seeing some other person. And, you know, it was, like, multiple people at once. And I was, you know, so the person who wrote in, who was very nice, said that they've never heard that before. They've never heard that from her friends. They've never heard that in, like, their research. So they wanted to know our sources and where we got that information from. So, to be direct, I have a Ouija board, okay? I use my Ouija board to contact whatever star we're going to be talking about on the podcast, okay? I have a notepad. I write notes down on what they say through the Ouija board. You know, I ask questions, but I mostly let them talk, you know, because they have a lot to say usually. And I think it was her who came through the board. Of course, anybody could come through the board. It could be, you know, like some random guy named Joe. I don't know. But I assumed it was Doris Day. So where do we get our sources? The spirit world, basically. Through the Ouija board, the spirit realm is where we get our sources. And, you know, if you have any kind of issue with some of our sources, you know, you can message us and we can talk about it. Or you can get your own Ouija board. I think they're on sale at Barnes & Noble. And they're in the toy section where the board games are, and they're made by Hasbro. So if you want to talk about it with the celeb and kind of figure out where they're coming from, that's good too. So, you know, that's basically our process in terms of researching. We just use the Ouija board. That's it. So that was my PSA. And take it up with the spirits, not us, if you have any issues with our content.
Do you think there's any chance that, like, Jack Carson or, like, Mickey Rooney or somebody that we talk about all the time could have been trolling you, though? I wonder if they could have given you, like, some kind of weird answer. It makes you wonder.
You know, maybe Martin Melcher got through the Ouija board and he was, like, speaking for her because, you know, he liked to do that. So, in her life when she was alive. So, you know, it could have been Martin Melcher. Could have been Jack Carson. It could have been Terry. It could have been her son. It could have been Rock Hudson. We don't know. There's so many people who could have gotten through. But, you know, I just take it at face value when the spirit says, I'm Doris Day. Here's what I got to say. And I'm like, okay, Doris, like, take it away. I got my pen and paper out.
That's fair enough. That's all you can ask for. Okay.
I know. She's really lovely to chat with through the Ouija board, I have to say. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, I'm going to let you, Meredith, talk about Pillow Talk and kind of introduce that timeline for Doris Day and her life.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Pillow Talk. So Pillow Talk was released in 1959 by Universal Pictures, and I know that it is one of her more popular movies. I feel like arguably it might be her most popular and well-known movie. Definitely argue me on that one. But from, like, off the top of my head, I feel like that's normally, that just seems to be like the most referenced one. So anyway, case in point, super popular movie. So basically this was the first movie that Doris starred in with Rock Hudson. So this movie kicked off their legendary partnership on screen. And that's another thing too, is like Doris Day and Rock Hudson, like both of those names are pretty synonymous, like with each other. When people think about one, often the other kind of comes with it. So this is a big deal in both of their careers. So the movie, basically this is it's a sex comedy. Interesting. I think it's interesting to see how this was. So 59, it going right into the 60s, how much of a 60s-esque kind of movie this is. It's just a very interesting time, I think, when they actually released this as well. So Doris Day plays this woman named Jan, and she is this successful interior decorator in New York City. She's this single career woman, which is like nice and refreshing to see as well, obviously, in old movies. And she's just like happy to be living her life. And then, of course, Rock Hudson plays her eventual love interest. And how this starts out, though, is that they squabble back and forth because he is this womanizing playboy songwriter who hogs the party line between them. And she only knows him over the phone at first. And he's just obnoxious. He sings this like same song to all these different women and just changes the name. So it's kind of like the running joke in the movie is how he just reuses his material on every single girl that he tries to woo. And so anyway, so the party line, of course, like for people who aren't familiar, is just this shared telephone line between, I don't know how many people, I think it's like different tenants in like an apartment building, or I can't remember like the different situations that how, like how many people could share a party line. But anyway, basically, it was like something that, you know, you had to wait your turn to talk on the phone to somebody if somebody else in your building was on the phone. So it could be very inconvenient and frustrating for people. So anyway, so this is how it all begins. So Jan and Brad, played by Rock Hudson, feud over the party line usage. And basically, Brad just trolls her a little bit. Like, he tells her that he thinks that she has problems in the bedroom and that she's just like bitter and jealous of him. And Jan's just like, no, you're a sex addict, you're annoying, like, shut up. And anyway, so this happens, but then Brad decides there's this whole plot basically where Brad finally meets Jan. And this is in the midst of Tony Randall's character, Jonathan, trying to woo Jan. He's really in love with her, and she's just like, she's not into him. But in, they all get intertwisted because Jonathan is Brad's buddy from college, and so they all get mixed in, and then Brad decides when he sees Jan, he's attracted to her, but he's like, he has to put on a fake persona because he doesn't want her to know that he is the guy on the party line who she hates. So he makes up this whole persona, like he's supposed to be this smooth-talking, charming, sweet guy from Texas, and he calls himself Rex Stetson, which I think that's, like, a really funny name. I love that. And he's this supposed wealthy Texas rancher. And so they start seeing each other. She's really into him. And she tells Brad, quote-unquote Brad, on the phone about him. And then Brad tries to play mind games with her. And he's like, you know, this guy just seems too good to be true. And then eventually there's this whole thing where he tries to make Brad or Rex seem, because he's such a gentleman, he tries to make him seem like he's secretly gay. And so there's this whole storyline where she's just questioning everything. Anyway, so there's just this whole crisis of identity in this movie. And I never thought about this until watching it the other night. And I don't know if you agree with this, but I realized that there are some similarities between this and The Shop Around the Corner / In the Good Old Summertime / You've Got Mail. I said, like I said, I never saw the similarity before, but I think like that whole, the fighting thing, but also being in love and not knowing that this is the person you're fighting with. I was like, oh my God, I see the similarity here. And I love that trope. Like, that's one of my favorite things. I love the, like, people who go from, like, the fighting to being in love. But anyway, so it's just this whole kind of screwball thing where they just go back and forth between Brad and Jan and Rex and Jan. And just the chemistry between Doris Day and Rock Hudson is amazing. It's palpable. Doris said that they became instant friends when they started working with each other, and I think it's really obvious. They just play off each other so well. And on screen, of course, like, I think they still have a pretty good, like, kind of a sexual energy, sexual chemistry together. Like, they act like they want to jump in bed with each other all the time, especially when they're fighting. And I live for that content. I think that they're so good at portraying these characters who are just, like, sexually frustrated and frustrated with each other.
So I was going to bring up, if I can, like, briefly, that Rock Hudson actually was hesitant to appear in this film. Because he thought it was too risque.
Really?
Yeah, and he didn't like the first, like, I guess the first kind of draft of the plot synopsis.
Uh-huh.
But after reading the final script, he changed his mind. And he was impressed with a lot of the dialogue. And he was kind of relieved from some of his concerns by the director of the film. To kind of say, you know, you have to play it straight. Like, don't play it too comedic. Because it'll come off more comedic if you just play it straight. And I do love that this really was the first film that kind of skyrocketed their collaboration on two other films. And I love that they had such, like, a great off chemistry connection. In Rock Hudson's memoir, he stated that they both had a lot of trouble trying not to laugh while shooting a lot of the film. And he used to call Doris Eunice Blotter because it made him laugh. And then she would call him Roy Harold, which was his name that he was given when he was born. And he credited Rock Hudson a lot of their naturalness in their films to actually really liking each other and having very strong personalities that just work so well together. And I just love them so much. It actually was like a really huge success, the film. It earned over $7.5 million, which is, I think that's a lot. Sounds like a lot. And as soon as the film was, they were done with the film, they were like, we had so much fun that we need to make another one. So obviously they paired with Randall again, and then they made Lover Come Back from 1961 and Send Me No Flowers in 1964. Which I really liked. Send Me No Flowers. Sometimes Pillow Talk and Send Me No Flowers are like kind of neck and neck in terms of my favoritism of their films together. Lover Come Back is probably the last one. I liked it, but I didn't find it as good as the others.
Yeah. You know, it's been a while since I've seen the other two, and so I honestly can't remember which one's my favorite. I need to rewatch those, and then I will come back to you with that. Also, it's worth mentioning, I completely forgot to mention, that there's a really good supporting cast, and Thelma Ritter plays Alma, who is, I'm blanking on this too, she's the housekeeper, if I'm correct on that. Why am I blanking?
Yeah, she's the housekeeper for Doris Day.
Thank you. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I was like, she's always a very good person just to see on screen. Anytime Thelma Ritter is there, it's like, okay, this is gonna be certified Kino movie. But I'm using my film nerd talk here. So it's interesting, just a quick note on the backstory of the production. So Pillow Talks, the script, from what I've read here, it says that it was turned down and then bought back by RKO Studios several times in the late 40s and early 50s until Doris's then husband, Marty Melcher, who you brought up earlier, in his Arwen Productions, bought the script back and took it to Universal. So according to Doris in her autobiography co-written by A.E. Hotchner, which I said this on the last podcast, but again, I highly recommend reading it if you haven't. But according to her in this autobiography, the film was initially titled Pillow Talk, but that title basically was not received well by the production code administration. So Melcher tried to get Ross Hunter, the co-producer of the movie, to change the name to Any Way the Wind Blows, which was the name of a song he was about to publish. But Ross Hunter decided to stick it out and just keep the name Pillow Talk, which I think in hindsight was probably a good idea. It's a great title. And so also the original ending planned for the film was to have Jan, of course, played by Doris Day, after using her trick in Brad's apartment to lock the door, and then, you know, she locks the door and gives him like a knowing smile. It was planned that she was going to shut off the light and say, quote, all apartments look alike in the dark. This open ending was changed in the final film to show that Jan and Brad got married and are now expecting a baby, which also I do like that running joke where the doctor hears, like, there was like that one scene where Rock comes in and he, out of context, says something about like he's gonna have a baby, and he makes it sound like he's gonna have a baby, and there's this doctor who is just absolutely gobsmacked, and he like becomes obsessed with Brad because he's like, this man is gonna have a baby, I need to check him out. And so anyway, like, I love that at the ending there's still that running gag that, you know, Rock comes in and he says, we're gonna have a baby, and this guy's like, oh. So anyway, honestly, I think it's worth it just for that alone. I just love that joke. But
you could read that, I guess, as not progressive. But actually, he's like, this is science. Science can be furthered. We must learn about this. And I'm like, you know, actually, in classic films, in terms of like all the doctors I've seen in these films, I'm like, this is probably the most progressive doctor I've ever seen. And he even tells the nurse, he's like, she's like, but that's not possible. Or, you know, she basically implies that that's not possible. And he's like, you know, anything is possible with science.
We love
sit your ass down.
We stan him.
Yes.
Oh my God. So yeah, and that's a great to note that as well. I agree with you on that. Really quick also, so the casting, you mentioned this a few minutes ago with Rock Hudson, how this, well, I think you did, or there was something you kind of mentioned that made me think of this at least. So Rock Hudson, I totally forgot that he was known for doing dramas before this. And it's like, I love these stories, you know, where like somebody sees something in an actor that maybe nobody else sees. And I love that, you know, basically they were like, hey, Rock Hudson, I think he could be really funny. Let's put him in this movie. And I love that. I love when people like take the chances on these people and then it gets proven right. And you're like, wow, this is beautiful. But that happened with Rock Hudson. I know the two movies from the 50s, well, no, three movies from the 50s I really like him in are, well, the two Douglas Sirk movies that I can, off the top of my head, All That Heaven Allows and Magnificent Obsession, like, really good. And then Giant as well. Love him in that one. So it is interesting, yeah, to see him, his career just do this complete turn. And then also it says that Ross Hunter, the co-producer, pointed out to Doris Day that she had the potential to be sexy. And I guess read that as you will. like, girl already knew, probably no. But basically, he recruited costume designer. I don't know if it's Jean-Louis, probably, or it could be Jean Lewis, if you're from Missouri like me. Terrible. How to do the Midwestern joke. But yeah, Jean-Louis. Designed, it says on here, it was either 18 or 24 costumes. I don't know. So he designed a number of costumes for Doris Day to wear. Hunter supposedly said to Doris, quote unquote, "You are sexy, Doris, and it's about time you deal with it. If you allow me to get Jean-Louis to do your clothes, I mean a really sensational wardrobe that will show off that wild fanny of yours, oh my God, and get some wonderful makeup on you and chic you up and get a great hairdo that lifts you, why every secretary and every housewife will say, look at that. Look what Doris has done to herself. Maybe I can do the same thing." And Doris supposedly acknowledged that the film, Pillow Talk, transformed her from the girl next door to classy sex symbol. Yeah, so anyway, so it's just like it's a whole, this movie, besides the story itself being really fun and interesting, I think the backstory behind it is just as interesting, looking at the trajectory of Rock and Doris's career. So
love that he was like, if you look sexy, other women will be like, I should look sexy too. No, we're not rich like movies. Just because, you know, a celebrity wears a very nice outfit doesn't mean that we can find a similar outfit like that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Doris Day, you're right. Doris Day already knew she was sexy. She didn't need someone to tell her that.
Amen. You're amen, like, to that.
Girl already knew. Come on.
yep. I know. So, yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to bring up one small point about kind of their performances or the characters they play. I would say maybe more so in this film, but it can apply to all of their films together, Doris Day and Rock Hudson. It's kind of like they're playing drag versions of themselves.
Interesting.
If that makes sense at all. Uh-huh. You know, Doris is playing a exaggerated version of herself. You know, she's actually, and she said this before in interviews, that's the characters she plays in those films are not her. They're not really how she sees herself, so it's an exaggerated version of herself. And then Rock Hudson obviously was not a straight man, literally, and he was not, I'm not talking about in a comedic sense, and he was playing an exaggerated version of what people would consider to be the ideal leading man. So, yeah, they just kind of seem like, yeah, drag versions of themselves, which is a good thing because it works so well and it makes their performances so over the top, which is how, that's the reason why the film works, is because, again, they're playing it so straight that it's, it turns into kind of like an over the top campy film.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's a really good point. It definitely does have some of that camp, and I think maybe that's a big part of why it's so fun to watch it, just because of the overtop. And I don't know. That definitely helps also with the, like, the one scene toward the end when she, when Jan just goes crazy with decorating Brad's apartment, and it's just insane. And I don't know, like, just the visuals of it and everything. It's very colorful. And I feel like that really adds to the I guess the vibe, the style of just that over the top kind of campy thing. So yeah. Just a quick note also for me, just to kind of wrap up my thoughts, or sort of thoughts and facts. So the critical reception was mostly positive at the time of the release of the movie. And also Doris was nominated. Let's see, she was nominated for Best Actress in a Leading Role. Thelma Ritter was nominated for Best Actress in a Supporting Role. And then there's also nominations for the production for Best Art Direction, Set Decoration, and then Best Music Scoring of a Dramatic or Comedy Picture. The film did win one Academy Award for Best Writing, Story, and Screenplay. And also it was nominated for several Golden Globes as well. So all in all, like I said at the beginning, you know, it's still very well remembered by Doris Day fans and Rock Hudson fans. And I probably think it's a really fun movie and just something kind of lighthearted to be able to put on, whether it's just in the background or you should pay attention to it. But also it's nice in the background if it's one of those kind of days. But yeah, Millie, did you have any other thoughts about the movie as well?
Yeah, kind of a tie-in between our last episode. We kind of stated that On Moonlight Bay was one of those films that was kind of the building block to stardom for her. You know, it wasn't like an instant success where she was just the you know, best actress of all time or most popular actress of all time. But Pillow Talk really also helped kind of propel her and revitalize her career. You know, before then, she had been making some more musicals and kind of getting a little bit diverse with the different films that she was doing. And her contract at Warner Brothers ended. So in 1954 with Lucky Me, which was with Robert Cummings, and Young at Heart with Frank Sinatra, both the same year. And so as a free agent, she made a biopic, Love Me or Leave Me, in 1955, which was about the 1920 singer Ruth Etting. And then she kind of took a different turn into some more kind of different films from her romantic comedies or musicals, which was The Man Who Knew Too Much from 1956, the Alfred Hitchcock remake of his film from 1934. And then Julie, which was a thriller from 1956 with Luis Jordan as her psycho husband. And then she returned to Warner's, I know, right? Hot as a psycho. She returned to Warner Brothers for one of her best musicals, like we talked about last time, The Pajama Game from 1957. Then she went to Paramount to do Teacher's Pet in 1958. And then did some other comedies like Tunnel of Love for MGM and It Happened with Jane for Columbia. And like I said, Pillow Talk came around and totally revitalized her career because instead of just a romantic comedy, it was, you know, coined as a sex comedy. And good old Ross Hunter, you know, really worked hard on the film and gave her kind of a new identity. And then, you know, she obviously went on to do the other two films with Rock Hudson. And then she did, she returned in 1960 to MGM to do another wholesome comedy called Please Don't Eat the Daisies from 1960. And that is kind of where we happen upon Midnight Lace from 1960, which was the second film that we watched for the part two of Doris Day Extravaganza. I love calling it that for some reason. It just sounds so over the top. And I just wanted to touch on the fact that, you know, this was a very different kind of thriller that she had done, really, since she started her career. Of course, she had been in other thrillers, and like The Man Who Knew Too Much, or even Storm Warning, the film about the Ku Klux Klan with Ronald Reagan. Such an odd casting. I don't know. That's something's very odd about that casting to me. And she was also in Julie, which I just mentioned. So she had been in a few different thrillers throughout her career, but this is a very different kind of thriller. You know, it basically is a terrified wife melodrama. You kind of liken it to a woman's picture from the 30s and 40s. And it basically is, she's the terrified wife. In London, she's American. Her spouse is a suave British businessman named Rex Harrison. And she just basically is harassed by Roddy McDowell. No, Roddy McDowell's disembodied voice throughout the entire film. This person keeps calling her and harassing her, saying he's going to kill her. He just like a lot of taunting things. And she keeps telling her friends, one of her friends played by Myrna Loy, and her husband Rex Harrison, and this really handsome man who's working on a, I guess he's doing construction right in front of her building, just so happens to be there. And they don't believe her because they never see the voice, never hear the voice. And so it's basically her running around saying, you know, this crazy thing is happening to me. No one will believe me. And they're like, are you sure, though? They're like, believing women is really hard. It takes a lot of effort to believe women. So I think you're just being really emotional.
The gaslighting in this movie is so stressful.
I know. This movie should just have been called Gaslight 1960, because that's pretty much what it is. And basically, she plays the terrified wife pretty well. She is very over the top with her performance, and I think it actually works really well. I didn't see it as too melodramatic. But she talked about in her book, Doris Day, her own story that Meredith brought up earlier, that her main objection was the emotional demands of the role, particularly the scenes where she was in grave danger. And then this is her quote: to convey the terror of my reaction, I recreated the ghostly abuses of Al Jordan. Remember her first husband that I brought up in the last episode. In one scene in which I had to become hysterical, I imposed on myself that moment when I was pregnant and ill, and Al Jordan burst into my room, dragged me from the bed, and hurled me against the wall. I wasn't acting hysterical. I was hysterical. So at the end of the scene, I collapsed in a real faint. Everyone was terribly alarmed. The director, David Miller, suspended further production. I was carried to my dressing room. Marty and Ross Hunter hurried to my side. My pretend life and my real life had fused. I just can't walk away from a scene and shed my emotions.
Dang, I didn't... Well, I don't remember that because I've read that before, but wow. Huh.
I mean, who can blame her? Like,
yeah.
She basically cited, like, filming that, you know, doing that film and having to kind of relive those kind of emotions as being so taxing and kind of traumatizing and emotionally draining that she didn't want to ever do another thriller again. She wanted to just do romantic comedies.
Yeah, wow. That makes so much sense now. Like, the one scene where she's being... She out on the ledge or whatever it is. I mean, several times, obviously, that she's, like, screaming bloody murder, but oh my god, that makes so much sense now, like thinking back, like where she's just, it's like blood-curdling screaming. Oh my god, that makes it so much more disturbing to like to know that. Wow.
And I totally thought that that's what she, you know, it's like so close to what she endured, you know, maybe not exactly, but I mean, it's abuse is abuse, so It's just, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to relive trauma, so it makes sense why she wants to portray this over-exaggerated version of herself in the musicals, because that's obviously so much more pleasant than having to just act like yourself, and when you're not having a good time in your life, it's not really fun to probably replay those for a film. So, you know. But the irony, the funny thing is that, because obviously I said Myrna Loy was in this film, she was like, I had a good time.
Never change, Myrna.
I know, she's like, you know, I liked working on this film. So, I love that Myrna had a good time. She said that the only person that wasn't very nice on the set was Rex Harrison, but she said that she thought it was because his wife had basically died in a year before.
Oh yeah. Okay. Is this the part where we talked about Rex Harrison, or I don't know if we saved that, but that's interesting.
It's always time to talk about sexy Rexy.
Spill the tea, Myrna. I need to. Yes. I'll dial in on my. Well, I don't have a Ouija board, but I'm gonna go to. I'll go to like Walmart or something and get one.
Very easy to find.
I'm scared to use it. I'm like gonna get in contact with like Satan or something, and it's gonna be like, hey, this is Myrna Loy, but it's actually evil Mickey Rooney or something, or like some other kind of spawn of Satan, and I'm gonna be cursed. And anyway, I'm spiraling here, but
it's okay. You know, someday when you come and visit me, we will call as many celebrities as we can on the Ouija board.
I'll do that with you. Yes.
it won't be scary. You know, maybe the worst thing that'll happen is that we get like Al Jolson through the Ouija board or something, but you know,
we'll hang
other
up on
than
him.
That, I think it'll be okay. One thing that I find really funny too is that, so John Gavin was in this film, and again, Ross Hunter was trying to kind of mold him into the new Rock Hudson, which I find very funny because he's very one-dimensional. He doesn't really have a lot of like unique qualities. He's a really good, like, you know, second or third banana, but I couldn't ever see him as a leading man. But you know, he plays obviously Sam in Psycho, if anybody has seen that. But it's funny because Myrna said that she used to tease John Gavin about his right-wing, like, political beliefs, and that she said, you'd better be careful, I warned him. You shouldn't be seen with me. And then she said, he must have been careful because he rode Reagan's coattails right into an ambassadorship. So, apparently he was, he served as U.S. ambassador to Mexico in 81 to 86.
I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Isn't he still alive? Or no, did he die?
He died a couple or a few years ago. He lived to a pretty good age. I'm not going to lie, but he's another one who I think is really cute. Like, I see him and I'm just like, I feel like I'm just objectifying everybody. Like, oh, he's so hot. Louis Giordano is one of my top Hollywood crushes. But yeah, no, John Gavin, I think he's kind of a babe. Because the night when we were watching it the other night, I could not think of his name, and I was like, isn't that the guy from Psycho? I was like, what's his name? And then you were like, yeah. And then for some reason, I don't think I looked him up, and yeah, I usually do. I don't know why I forgot to do that. But yeah, John Gavin, let's see, it looks like he died, 3 years ago last February, so, wow, it's been already several years. I thought it was maybe just like 1 or 2 years, so, wow. Yeah,
I think, so again, kind of going back to Rex Harrison real quick, he credits Doris Day as being really nice to him, and actually she said that, you know, his kind of jokes or his kind of light-hearted sense of humor really helped her in while filming this film because it was so emotionally exhausting for her. But yeah, so the personal life of Rex Harrison is kind of really depressing. So just as a brief summary. So she, so he, well, Rex is a, Rex is a he, but you know, who knows? So Rex Harrison was married to an actress named Kay Kendall from 1957 to 1959. Before that, he was married to an actress named Lily Palmer from 1943 to 1957. So basically, he married Palmer, and he had kind of, they were both having affairs, but he divorced Palmer in 1957, or they both agreed to divorce so that he could marry actress Kay Kendall, because she was diagnosed with myeloid leukemia in 1959. And he wanted to be able to take care of her. So that's why he divorced Palmer. And Palmer and him agreed to kind of get back together. So he took care of her. And actually, she didn't know that she had leukemia. She just thought that she had, like, an iron deficiency. I guess, like, the doctors kept, like, the truth away from her. Like, they didn't tell her that she had leukemia. They just let her believe that she had iron deficiency.
Huh.
Which is, like, kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And he took care of her, and then he, you know, she died. And then he was going to marry Lily Palmer again, and she was like, actually, I fell in love with this guy I was having an affair with. Sorry. And so they didn't get married. So it's actually kind of sad. At least I think it's sad. So maybe that is why he was kind of depressed during that time, or maybe not in the best mood. So yeah, he cared for her until her death at age 32, which was pretty young.
Wow.
Huh. Yeah. So they started having an affair together in 1955. But Lily Palmer, you know, was like, oh, I'm having an affair too. So, like, no worries.
Thank you.
I'm just like, okay. So, yeah, he agreed to divorce Palmer so that he could care for Kendall and provide for her, until she died. But I just think it's kind of crazy that she was never told of her illness. She just believed the whole time she had an iron deficiency.
Like, that's, like, probably highly unethical. I mean, I'm assuming that probably is actually unethical, but, like, who knows? It makes me wonder if it's the doctors thought they were just, like, sort of doing her a service, like, oh, if she doesn't know, maybe she's a warrior or something, and, like, could understand that aspect. Like, you don't want to have to tell people, but, yeah, that's a little problematic, a little weird. Yeah
it's, I mean, I don't know, like, were they just afraid she was gonna freak out? I mean, she's,
yeah,
I don't know why you would feel like it's just better this way that she doesn't know, but, you know, okay.
I really did that in movies, honestly. Like, it seems like a movie thing. I think they'd, like, pull that stunt in real life, but
I know, I'm like, this is real life. But it's interesting that I didn't know that. So I didn't know Rex Harrison in his autobiography. I didn't know he had one. I didn't know he had an autobiography called A Damned Serious Business. But in his autobiography, he also stated that he thought it was such a pity that he couldn't have played with opposite of Day and more romantic comedies, because he really liked doing romantic comedies. And they just never starred in another film together. And I also didn't know Myrna Loy had an autobiography called Myrna Loy, Being and Becoming. But, you know, I'd love to read both of those. There's so many autobiographies that I have to read.
Yeah. I have collected a lot of autobiographies, and I need to probably send some to you at some point. We just need to FaceTime. I'm going to, like, pull out a whole stack and just be like, okay, which, like, take it or leave it. Because I need to read them, because I've had some for years, and I don't think I had Myrna Loy's, but as you were talking about them, I was, like, thinking in my head, I'm like, do I have those? I was like, I want to get Myrna Loy, though. She's, like, one of my favorites, so, yeah, that's really cool.
So, I have to say this one thing, because it cracked me up when I read it, but I was reading an article about Midnight Lace, and it was someone likened, you know, Roddy McDowell is obviously the disembodied voice that's harassing her, which isn't really a spoiler. It's just kind of like behind the scenes, like trivia. But someone likened his voice to something similar to how a character in Courage the Cowardly Dog would sound. And I was like, I'm fucking dead. Goodbye. It's so true, though. It's so true.
Okay, that's, I love that, number one. Number two, I know I feel like I hyped it up, but like before we watched it the other night, because this is a side note, like we mentioned this, like our other, the first two movies, we typically stream the movies that we're going to watch like the night or two before. So anyway, this is the other night when we were watching both movies. I said before Midnight Lace, since Amelia hadn't seen it, I was just like, oh yeah, there's this creepy voice. And for some reason, when I watched it, it like scared the hell out of me, because it's just this really weird high-pitched voice. And then I feel like when we watched it, I thought it was like kind of, I think it's more like funny sounding, and not to, like, I feel like that's that, I have like energy of somebody who's laughing at unintentional things in like old movie crowds by saying that, but like, I don't know, I think it's kind of funny, but it's also still creepy. I think it also would have been really funny. I know this would not have fit the mood of the movie, but wouldn't it have been like really hilarious if Roddy McDowell, like if actually he was the killer, like they were just like had to actually acknowledge that Roddy McDowell was like the fucking killer, and
yes,
like him in real
life.
Yeah, they're like, oh my god, Roddy McDowell's the one who's trying to kill me. Fuck.
I honestly think it, like when we were starting the film, you're like, oh my god, it's so creepy. Like you kept just like, I was like, should we go on? I thought it was really annoying. I thought his voice was really annoying. Like, I'd actually just start hanging up the phone. Like, I'd be like, this is the most annoying voice. Ugh, I can't listen to it any longer.
Somebody in Letterboxd said that too. They were like, obviously, like, we wouldn't have had a movie, but couldn't she just have not answered the phone? And I was like, yeah.
I mean, one, you know, that would probably, you know, one, she could not answer the phone, and two, people could just believe her. But if both of those things had happened, then there would be no film. But it's, I do like that everyone is just so gaslighty. It's so annoying.
Yeah.
I'm like, god, is it really that hard to take your time and just listen and believe her? Yeah. I don't know why it's like just so crazy. And I think it's just a big, you know, it's still very prevalent, like the same thing where women are like, this happened to me, though. I don't know, did it?
Yes, yeah.
Like, you're just being a little too emotional. And no, I'm emotional because someone's trying to kill me. Thank you very much.
Oh my god. Yeah, good, really good commentary. Oh my god. Yeah, so overall, since this was your first viewing of it, what did you think? Like, did you... Yeah, because obviously, like, talking about it, you seem to definitely have at least liked it somewhat, or have parts that you liked, but yeah, overall, would you say you were a fan of the movie? Like, would you watch it again? What do you think on that?
So, on Letterboxd, I rated it a 3.5 out of 5. I liked it, but I think it moved a little too slow. For me, although people cite it as moving pretty fast, I thought it moved a little slow. I really wish, and I know this wouldn't have been possible in 1960, but I wish she would have been, like, it would have just been up the ante, like, a little bit more. Like, I wish she would have been it would have been a slasher, and I wish she would have been the final girl with a knife, exacting revenge. And oh my god, I bet that would have felt so cathartic for her.
Could you imagine if, I was going to say, like, what if, like, Hitchcock did it or something, which, you know, it still wouldn't have gotten that grisly or anything, but I think I forgot to, I haven't logged this on Letterboxd yet, did I? No. American Pie was way before that. I'm looking at my account, and I was like, last thing I have, really off topic, but it's like, I did an American Pie marathon. I'm going to get, like, judged for that, but I keep, like, telling people that. I don't know what I expect, but I have, like, the last two American Pie, like, the main movies logged, and then I have Singing in the Rain, and then I have Superbad. Superbad was after, so oops. Okay.
I don't remember Doris Day being in those. What character does she play in those?
She could have played the old woman in Superbad. Wait, I was gonna ask if you've seen Superbad and get way off topic.
I have not.
I love that movie. Okay, I was gonna say there's an old woman who is in one part. She could have been that, but she wouldn't have said fucking, I don't think, because the woman does say fucking. Have fun fucking Jules. Anyway, I was gonna say at first I was like, I think I rated it a 3.5 as well. Going back, that's really weird. Maybe I just didn't log the date that I watched it or whatever, because I swear I did. I'm trying to look really quick and see what I have. But anyway, I feel like I'm in the same level as you. Although, like, I watched it for the first time. It's been a few years. And, oh, yeah, on Letterboxd it just says, like, watched it and have a rating, so I'll do that. I think I'm also really at, like, a 3 or 3.5. I feel like the first time I watched it, I feel like I liked it maybe a little bit better. I don't know. Because I know I was pretty excited to see it again. And I think there are aspects of it that I do enjoy. I think it's just mostly, like, how I like watching Doris in a thriller. I think it's just because it's so different. And I think it, I agree. I think it's also a pretty slow-moving movie. I think it's on the slow side. And I don't know. I think at times it definitely can go kind of over the top. But I think maybe that's sort of the fun quality of it. Just that era, early 60s, just the mood and everything, I think it really goes with that. I was also going to mention, I almost forgot to bring this up, but when we were watching it the other night, it occurred to me that it made me think of the movie Wait Until Dark with Audrey Hepburn that was released in 1967. It's an interesting parallel. I don't know why, but it just came to my mind. I was like, oh, this, it really makes me think of Audrey in that movie. And I think it's just like there's something fun about watching actresses like that, where Audrey was also normally known for, you know, like romantic comedies, lighter things. And so, you know, just seeing these women sort of by the 60s take on these different roles that are grittier, I think it's like a really fascinating thing to watch. And also I think just throwing out that Midnight Leaf and Wait Until Dark would be probably a kind of a fabulous double feature. So if I ever end up like programming something, I'm gonna do that. But yeah, I think it's interesting, especially compared to Pillow Talk and a lot of her earlier movies that we, you know, I feel like audiences normally think about all the lighthearted musicals she did, and just, you know, again comparing that stuff to her sex comedies and then the thrillers that she did. You know, I think she was a lot more multi-talented that people probably give her credit for, just because she was known for being Girl Next Door. And I think it's like important to look at her career and see that she really tried to go out of her probably comfort zone. I will dare to venture that probably her comfort zone, it seemed like it. So I don't know. I just think there's a lot of fascinating stuff to see from her.
Yeah, and I'd really like to continue to watch a lot of her filmography, especially some of the other thrillers that she did. I've already seen Storm Warning, but I really want to watch the film that she did with Luis Jordan. So that would be great to kind of explore further.
Yeah, I'd like to watch that at some point too. So maybe down the line, it's another episode idea or something where we can just talk about Louis Jardin. I want to have an excuse just to go off about him. So
yeah,
not go off on him. I'm not going to drag him. It's going to be good and kind and adoring and just beautiful person.
Yes. So that kind of wraps up our Doris Day extravaganza, looking at some of her films and, you know, the different kinds of films she made and just some of her life. And I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as we did. I really did enjoy kind of delving into her filmography, although I've already seen Pillow Talk, which I love. It's like one of the only films I've given like 4 to 4.5 or 5 stars repeatedly. I really learned a lot about her life and her career, so I'm hoping to kind of learn more once this podcast is over. But I just wanted to bring up our next couple of podcasts that we're going to be doing, just so you guys have an idea of what we're going to kind of be focusing on. So sometime next week, we're going to be doing our Video Nasty series again. So we're going to be exploring the film Eaten Alive, which is a 1976 film about a psychotic redneck in Louisiana who kills people who upsets him and feeds them to his alligators. And the cast is really crazy. I mostly chose this based on the cast, and so I'm really excited to watch it. I also was kind of, I'm trying to kind of transition us to watching cannibal films. This isn't necessarily a cannibal film because it's, I mean, well, it kind of is because it's alligators eating people. But it's not like human on human cannibalism. Wait, isn't that what cannibalism is? Human on human? Anyway. there's so many films on this Video Nasty list that are cannibal films. So I'm trying to ease us into that. And I think this one was just so different in terms of content. Like, I've never watched a psychotic redneck. I know that's a subgenre, I think, in slashers. Is there's like some kind of like redneck subgenre. But anyway, we'll be looking at that. And then the week after that, we'll be also doing a podcast with a man named David, or Dave, that I met on Twitter. And he works at a video rental store in New Zealand. And so we're going to just be talking to him about what it's like to work at a video rental store in 2020. And, you know, what it's like to work in one in New Zealand, because I've never been there. And also just how he got into film and how he got into collecting film, because he's very similar to me in terms of his interest in collecting physical media. So I think that will pair well with our Video Nasty series, since we'll be talking obviously about videotapes and Eaten Alive and just kind of the controversy around both of those things. So it'll be very fun. And one more promo for the Hollywood Legion Theater. They will be doing, again, I brought this up last time, a screening of Steamboat Bill Jr. And it's going to be a kind of collaboration with the silent film retro format, or the retro format musical director, Cliff Redelick, is going to be there. It's going to be in partnership with retro format silent films. And so the first screening is going to be on March 27th at 7:30 p.m. And it looks like there's still a few spots left on that. So if you're in the area, I would recommend getting on that so that you're able to get a spot. And also, it'll be with live keyboard accompaniment, which I think is so much fun. So that's always a good time. And then the second screening is on the same night. It's just going to be at 9:45 p.m. So March 27th, 9:45 p.m. And that one has a lot more spots than the earlier one. So if you want to go see it, maybe it's good to go see it the later one, because there's a lot of spots left. It's a very small kind of drive-in, so they can only allow for a certain amount of cars. So that's why it's kind of, you know, good to secure your tickets quickly. So that's kind of all I have. Meredith, do you have any other final thoughts?
No. I was trying to think of that earlier, see if there's anything that I knew of going on, like online or anything, and I can't think of anything. So for now, I think that sounds good. I wish I could join you at the drive-in at some point. I want to hit that up in LA. So it sounds really fun. But yeah, I'll try to, if there's anything throughout the next week that may be going on, I'll definitely share that on our social media, which is a good transition. I did not actually mean to transition that, but again, if you know, if you do not follow us on social media and are interested, you can find us at the Golden Girls Podcast, or just look up Golden Girls. We're on Twitter very actively, also active on Instagram, so look us up there. We are constantly posting polls or Mickey Rooney shit posts, stuff like that. So, you know, come to us for all of your content needs.
Yeah, we just did a new poll. We did two new polls recently. So I'm sure by the time that people listen to this, they won't be up anymore. But I'm gonna read them anyway, just because they're so good. And actually, Meredith, you got a lot more votes on yours. You got up to 44 votes.
Okay, good. I just retweeted it again for like a few minutes ago. It's like my second retweet. So, okay.
So the poll that Meredith asked is, do you prefer Doris Day's earlier films, so late 40s, mid 50s, or her later films, late 50s, late 60s? A lot of people have said later. Some people have said I love them equally, and the smallest vote is earlier. So a lot of people like her later stuff. And then my poll that I did is Sexy Rexy even that sexy? And I said, 33% said, hell yeah, how dare you. 0% said I would spank his monkey. I don't know why no one voted on that yet. and then 67% said, no, he looks like a sloth.
I should have voted for the spank because I did say yes. I voted on it already.
He kind of does look like a sloth in his later films. I don't know. He looks like some kind of animal, but maybe sloth isn't correct. Maybe it's, I don't know. He looks like something. I just can't put my finger on it.
I'm trying to think about it too. He's a very nice looking sloth. I don't know. We were just discussing it earlier, and I thought, I was like, yeah, he's kind of hot in a way, I think. Especially younger, but I know I'm cheating by like going back to his younger self, but there's some kind of hotness. I don't know.
I think he's hot. Like, yeah, you said in the ghost of Mrs. Muir, you know, area, oh, yeah. Like type of, you know, era. I agree with that. I think in Midnight Lace, not as much. He's like in sloth mode in Midnight Lace.
Okay, so you would not risk it all for, like, Midnight Lace era Sexy Rexy.
No, oh no. Oh no. Not at all. I'll go hang out with Roddy, or I'll go hang out with John McGavin or something. No thanks. I'll skip.
Roddy McDowell would be, like, fun to hang out with. Like, taking the photos and everything, like, I don't know. I was like, I would go take photos with Roddy McDowell any day, or like videos. I like it.
We love Roddy and his cartoon voice that he did that he did during the film. So we'll see you guys next week and the week after. I hope you enjoyed our Doris Day extravaganza, and we hope to hear you next. I guess you're not hearing us. We're not hearing you. I guess I hope that you hear us next time. Anyway, I hope you're there. I hope you're there in the big world, the big giant world. I need to take my meds. Anyway, I'll see you guys later.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.